The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
To Ernest Walsh, 17 August 1925. Have done 48,000 words on a novel. A swell novel. That's why I haven't sent you a Spanisher letter. It will be suppressed the day they publish it, but it's going to be a damn good one. It's about Paris and Spain. Hadley's gone up to Paris, and I've been working here on it. Worked straight through all night, several nights. You can have a chunk out of it later on, as work in progress, if you like. Very best to you both, and write me the dope. Splendid bullfights. Best always, Ernest. To Ezra Pound, 1925. Dear Uncle, thanks for lovely cow pictures. Have been working tail off on novel. 48,000 words writ, maybe more. 300 pages of closely writ. 4 more chap to do. Going to be good. All about Paris. Don't say the Reverend Dr. Lewis did this in 1914. He didn't. You will like some of it, I think. To Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, 20 August, 1925. Dear friends, you certainly must feel good about the proofs and the book. I'm so glad it's nearly done. I just got back yesterday. Hadley came up a week ago. I have been working very hard and done about 50-some thousand words on a novel. I want to get it finished now and then put it away and come back and work it over. Hadley came up and got the house all cleaned, etc., and I stayed down and worked and went swimming. Never worked so hard. Sometimes till 4 o'clock in the morning from after dinner, and sometimes, like now, it's about 4:30 a.m., and I couldn't sleep, so got up and writing now, and then start. It certainly is funny how your head, I mean my head, can go most of the time like a frozen cabbage, and then it can give you hell when it starts going. Have been so pleased to find it still functions.
That was Ernest Hemingway writing in 1925 to the magazine editor Ernest Walsh, his mentor Ezra Pound, and his friends Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. They don't come much more glamorous than that. He'd just turned 26 and was living in Paris. The novel he was writing was The Sun Also Rises. Hemingway might have been a careful novelist, but he was a notoriously slapdash correspondent. "Excuse the uppercase type, but the damn mill sticks otherwise, and I want to write this fast," he shouted to one correspondent. He dashed off notes so speedily that volume 2 of his collected letters, which has just been published by Cambridge University Press, only covers the 2 years from 1923 to 1925 before he had even published a novel. It's one of a clutch of collected letters that are being published this autumn. They include Darling Monster, that's Diana Cooper's letters to her son, John Julius Norwich, and an extraordinary correspondence between Christopher Isherwood and his young lover, Don Bacardi, which we'll be hearing about later. But first, with me in the studio is Simon Garfield, who was last on this podcast talking about maps. Ever ahead of the curve, his latest book is To the Letter, A Journey Through a Vanishing World, which traces the gentle art of correspondence back to its origins. Simon, I mentioned the Hemingway letters, and this is part of a massive project to collect. There's something like 6,000 letters, and it's going to run to 17 volumes. We haven't yet got to the first published novel. How valuable is this sort of exercise?
Well, I think with Hemingway, it is valuable. If you look at someone like T.S. Eliot, you could argue against it, because he's collected things and they've got gas bills in there and stuff, and you don't really want that. But as you say, Hemingway, you know, he's probably too drunk to use the phone, even if there would have been a phone there to dial correctly. And this is what he did. He vented his worldview and his spleen and kind of all his emotions.
You've got this fabulous Hemingway letter, which you have to fill it because the Hemingway estate are quite ferocious, aren't they, about title?
Expensive, I think, is the word really as well. This letter, in fact, came up at an auction.
So let's listen to a little bit of it now.
To Ezra Pound, 29 June, 1 July, 1925. Oh yes, Ford gave a talk in his best diasbraic, you spell it, style, on a subject announced as Mr. Ford Maddox, Maddox Ford will speak on new writers. No names were mentioned, but it went on 2 hours and was largely imaginary incidents in which Ford, representing the last living British Tory out of a German organ grinder, and Dante Gabriel Rossetti, of course, gave imaginary conversations between himself and Americans speaking an imaginary Yankee dialect in which he wasted the ignorant stockyardsers. The type of thing can be indicated by the anecdote he told of an American graduate of Yale, I think, who was so ignorant he said, "Say, Bo, who's this Napoleon they talk about? They never learned us nothing about him where I went to school." It gave his megalomania a gala night, a lovely evening. And you wonder why I come to this country to watch bulls. Bulls, at least, are not the greatest stylists in English. No bull has ever been a political exile. Bulls of 25 don't marry old women of 55 and expect to be invited to dinner. Bulls do not get you cited as correspondent in society divorce trials. Bulls do not borrow money. Bulls do not expect you to marry them and make an honest woman of them. Bulls are edible after they have been killed. Fewer bulls are homosexual. No bull has ever been at the Café du Dôme. Bulls are not Jews. Practically no bulls are bankers. Bulls kill for fun and are killed the same way, etc. To me, bulls ain't exotic. They are normal. And such a goddamn relief from all this horseshit about art, etc. Bulls know how to knock the horseshit out of a horse. They know how to open a horse up and see what makes him go. They are not sorry for the horse after they have killed him. They nose and poke to make sure he is dead. Bulls are not sentimental. They are celibates, but give them a chance to fuck, and they are there. Thank God for bulls. To hell with delicate studies of the American scene. Fuck the American scene. Fuck manners, customs, all that horse shit. Let us have more and better fucking, fighting, and bulls. Yours in Christian Science, Mother Eddie.
You know, this is the value of these kind of letters. They're absolutely of the moment. You kind of think, had he written this out in an email, he would have, perhaps Hemingway not, but sort of others would have thought, do I really want to say that? It's sort of going into some cloud somewhere in the, you know, in sort of the Midwest. It's going to be there for posterity. But with this, it's no holds barred.
It doesn't come across as a very nice man. It's anti-Semitic, among other things.
It's sort of anti-everything, including anti-Semitic. But it's clearly how he felt. And the value of this, of course, is you get a very, you know, true and accurate picture of the man. How drunk he was, of course. Albin Tram is an extraordinary thing. He collected letters from Napoleon to Einstein, and his letters came up for auction when he died. This particular sale at Christie's, you were salivating. If you were a letter collector, this was the holy grail, really.
So the Napoleon was most expensive, but among the literary ones, Hemingway went for £78,000, and poor old Charlotte Bronte only fetched
£21,600. It doesn't tell you about their literary value, obviously. It just tells you about their kind of, you know, are they in mode? You kind of think, well, Hemingway probably may, you know, gone to an American collector, and it's still part of the, he's still seen very much as part of our generation. Bronte's sort of further away.
What are the earliest surviving letters? When did the art of letter writing start?
The earliest one that we know of is unfortunately fictional, and it's in the Iliad and Homer. I begin the book with these ones that are real fragments. They aren't significant in themselves, but they're significant for what they represent. And they were found at the beginning of the 70s, although they're still being found now, about a mile south of Hadrian's Wall at a place called Vindolanda. Actually, these are some of the earliest Roman letters, or obviously earliest Greek letters.
Chips of wood, aren't they?
Chips of wood from oak and alder and birch. And they survived purely by chance, that the conditions in the soil, and these were letters that people think they threw away. So we're writing back to their loved ones in Rome, and it's thought that the closest letters that they had were probably died on them, the way you would maybe clasp a letter to your heart now. And these ones were kind of incidental and thrown away, but they're still fantastic because they reveal a layer of kind of Roman life that we had no idea about. And it's sort of send more clothes and it's send more beer, and I'm freezing here in Britain, and it's that kind of insight, that ability to kind of reveal the past in an incidental way.
But then there's the public side of letters. So you have Pliny the Younger describe, that's how we know about what happened in Pompeii and the eruption of Vesuvius, was because Pliny the Younger was sitting in a boat just off the coast, having been rescued.
He wrote it on request. Tacitus, a great historian, he was writing this huge history. The history doesn't survive, but the letters do. And it's the only account that we have.
Now, in the first century AD, you also have, I think this is really intriguing, the emergence of self-help literature in letters. And Seneca wrote 124 letters, supposedly to a friend, explaining how to live a good life.
It was that sort of strange time when rhetoric merged into letters, really. So he would write about, you know, how to be a good citizen and sort of live well, but then also how to be a good husband and how to tend for cattle and those kind of things. And they were definitely intended for publication. And then there were the letters that came after that, especially Roman letters that were written for delight. There's a very interesting comparison that a Greek and Roman historian made, which was that if you were to go around a museum and you look at the sculptures, the Greek ones are kind of somehow colder and the Roman ones are kind of warmer. And the same with letters. And with the first Roman letters, you got, as I said, a bit like the ones discovered at Vindolanda, the first sort of insight into kind of human character that don't read as if they were written to be read out in some temple somewhere.
And you've got this device running through the book of what you call an interlude. And it's this developing romance between, it's very touching, a Second World War signal man and his wife.
Yeah, I was very aware when I was writing the book that most of the letters that have survived tend to be from famous people, and that's why they survive. But I was very keen to get a collection of letters running through the book that the reader could follow very much as a kind of page turner, not knowing how things turned out. And it was a bit of luck, really. I'm a trustee of the Mass Observation, which began very much just before the war and has a huge amount of journals and diaries. And I called up the woman who runs the organisation. She said, oddly enough, 2 weeks ago, we received this extraordinary archive written by a man who was originally a postman. That was a reserved occupation until 1943, when he then went to North Africa. And he had time on his hands, and he wrote to all these sort of friends. And one person who he'd worked with the post office and had never had any, you know, strong relationship with wrote back. And then he wrote back. And then within about 3 months, it was clear that this was turning into more than just a sort of, well, it was platonic in that sense, but it was also very passionate. And then within 9 months, they were engaged. And this has all happened through letters. And it's just a fantastic, but the beauty of it is they write so elegantly. And you don't quite know what's going to happen, because at one point he gets captured in Greece. She doesn't know what's happened. So this comes from one of their sons. I kind of emailed him and said, look, you know, are you happy about this? And he said, yes, absolutely, because I think that it's a fantastic romance. And it had a very happy ending. So, you know, if anything shows the value of a long-standing correspondence and the value of keeping that correspondence, it's this.
Now, I'm going to pick you up on your thing about only the famous people's letters survive, because, and particularly with reference to the Paston letters, which I'm particularly passionate about. I absolutely adore the Paston letters. It's basically a sort of housewife in Norfolk in the Wars of the Roses who had to wear a breastplate to do her housework because she never knew when the neighbours were going to drop in.
Constantly under attack. I mean, the reason these survive is, in the main, they're kind of business letters. And she was writing to her family, her brother. They're not kind of famous, and obviously they became famous, not least when the letters turned up at the British Museum. And you get a different sort of insight. My favourite element of it is that it contains what is thought to be the very first Valentine's letter. Just saying, I miss you. So in the middle of all this business correspondence and finance going back and forth, and again, send me more this, you know, is there any way you can get material for a winter coat or whatever? There's just a thing saying, when are you back and I miss you? And it touches your heart. I mean, I found consistently through here that the letters that have an effect on us now are the ones that have, that reflect a similar emotion. And the emotions are inevitably love and longing and big dramatic historical events, and then the very personal ones as well. Because there's a lot of the Paston letters can be quite dull. They can be quite kind of business-like. But as a set of letters from the 15th century, hugely important.
Now, if we're talking star-crossed lovers, there's nobody more so in the 20th century than Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath. And You quote a sort of terrible, tragic letter from Ted the day after Sylvia died. "Dear Dan and Helga, Sylvia killed herself on Monday morning. She seemed to be getting in good shape. She was writing again and she was making enough money getting all sorts of commissions, good reviews for her novel, then a series of things, solicitors' letters, etc., piled up. She flared up. The doctor put her on very heavy sedatives and in the gap between one pill and the next, she turned on the oven and gassed herself. A nurse was to arrive at 9 a.m, couldn't get in, and it was at 11 a.m. before they finally got to Sylvia. She was still warm. The funeral's in Yorkshire on Monday."
Heartbreaking, and in a way, very untypical. You can tell from that, having read earlier ones, how shocked he was and how cold he was, and these are the facts, this is what happened. Whereas before, you know, their relationship soured. It's lyrical and it's poetic, as you would imagine. It's beautifully written. And he's the only person, actually, in the book who I feature a whole chapter on. I think I call him the modern master.
It has the postscript, that letter. "I was the one who could have helped her and the only one that couldn't see that she really needed it at this time. No doubt where the blame lies." And you make the case that if these letters had been made public earlier, he might not have become the villain that he became.
I think it's no coincidence that the collection that many Ted Hughes fans and scholars regard as his greatest work was his last collection, The Birthday Letters, which is obviously a sort of explanation to anyone who wants to listen, and to himself, really, about what happened. The whole collection is really about his relationship with Sylvia. And he could have let some of those out earlier as well, because a lot of those were written, you know, at the time. Letters have that power, don't they, to sort of rewire history and rewrite history in a way. We find a letter in an attic, in our attic, perhaps, that tells us stuff about our dad that we never knew. And in this case, you're right, had that been out earlier, it shows him, you know, sort of great sympathy and great regret and everything else. But clearly their relationship became totally impossible and he felt he couldn't help her. But he also wasn't going to be the sort of one who would get into a sort of tit-for-tat thing with the newspapers or anyone who wrote to him or any Plath fans.
Do you think the fact that so many of these books of letters are being published now and about letters is because we're just witnessing the death of the letter?
In a way, we're in a golden age, you know, it's a last hurrah, I think. There's also the Paul Cézanne letters and the P.G. Wodehouse letters appeared not so long ago as well. Now, obviously, these are old. I mean, Don Bacardi is the only one of that list to be alive still. But we're not going to have those sorts of collections appearing in 50 years' time, 100 years' time, you know. The things we may have, kind of email collections on e-books, how horrific would that be? You know, everything would look exactly the same, much shorter. We write emails, are fantastic. God, you know, who doesn't love the efficiency and speed of emails and what they can do and the amount of information they can carry, but what they don't have is kind of depth. What they don't have, I think, I'm not one for writing my emotions down in kind of emails, partly because I think it's odd writing on a keyboard. You know, the how much you would sort of love someone. I think love letters. You still want to send love letters. That's the reason we don't send sort of condolence emails.
But
you know,
Hemingway was writing on a typewriter. He didn't write in handwriting.
Oh yeah, but it's still that human connection. And Ted Hughes kind of wrote a lot as well on type. But that's absolutely that kind of human connection. And it's that personal thing. You get it. You put the paper into the typewriter, you tap on it, you take it out, you make amendments, probably you put it in an envelope, you go to the post, you know, all of those kind of things are very, very personal, and it's that physical thing. And all letters, Hemingway letters, beautiful things to look at, because you know the typewriter jams and he can't write fast enough and there'll be whatever whiskey stains that kind of on them or rum or whatever. And towards the end of the book I look at how we will discover these letters, how they will be stored, or how our emails will be stored. Now things are higgledy-piggledy, or they're stored by an estate. You know, I end up talking to the Harry Ransom Center, who are in Texas, who are a very wealthy university institution buying up all these kind of archives, and they are grappling, along with Yale and the British Library and lots of other institutions, of how are we going to actually reflect the correspondence of influential artists in the future. And they are having big debates going back and forth about computer storage. Interestingly, the way forward might be what Emory University did a few years ago. And they bought not only Salman Rushdie's letters, but also his computers. So you can now sit at a computer and be a virtual Salman. And, you know, if you can probably see in Word the way he changed satanic verses and all of that. And that might be the way we're going. But the most chilling thing for me is that, so I talked to a woman called Megan Barnard, who is the assistant curator at Harry Ransom. And she says that she's noticed that her interns don't write any letters and they hardly write emails, because obviously what they do now is text and they tweet and they direct message and they Facebook and everything else. And she kind of thinks, well, actually, if this is the future, are emails just a sort of transitory bridge to not writing at all? Are we going to be able to tell our history in the future the way we've told it in the past?
Simon, thank you very much. And to the letter, A Journey Through a Vanishing World is published by Canongate. Now, if you're talking love letters, our next correspondent has the last word. He is Don Bacardi, who has been much referred to in this podcast, and he has just published his 33-year correspondence with his lover, Christopher Isherwood. He joined us with editor Catherine Bucknell to explain The Animals, the title of which will shortly become clear.
Today I've been working all day on my novel, and now I'll work and work and work. I'll write to Kitty nearly every day for a while, until he settles down, because I know it helps to get letters, but Kitty isn't to answer if he's too busy. Dobbin will understand. Sweetheart, in all the years we've been together, I've never felt closer to you than I do now. Please know that I'm constantly thinking of you, and be certain of my love, always and always, D. Monday, January the 31st, 1961, London. My darling, his letter was waiting for Kitty when he arrived this morning, and Kitty was so glad. His dear, sweet horse had been thinking of him. A wonderful letter that helped Kitty so much. Kitty was very frightened and wide-eyed and ruffled, and then there was Dobbin's love and assurance to calm him. And Kitty had been thinking so much of his horse, and wanting him, and needing, and loving him so much.
He was 48, exactly 30 years between our ages. I met him with my brother, who was a very good-looking young man, and he had lots of admirers on the beach, and Chris was a beachgoer too, and he was very attracted to Ted, my brother, and I was just his little brother tagging along. So I think I met Chris actually first when I was 16. So I knew him vaguely for a couple of years before we got to know each other much better.
So this is a big age gap, and you're talking about somebody who was really very famous by then, and mm-hmm. There you were, a teenager with no experience of the world. What was it that drew you to each other?
Chris's charm, really. He made the age difference irrelevant because he connected immediately. I felt comfortable with him. He had that kind of charm. He could charm just about anybody, but if it happened to be an attractive young man, his charm was at its very best.
Now, these letters start 4 years after you met. Mm-hmm. What happened to make you suddenly start writing to each other?
Separation. That was our first serious separation, and he left me alone in London in order to go up to visit his mother and brother. And I think he thought it best to prepare them, because I was 21. I looked very much younger. When we first went to New York together, a serious rumor went around town that Christopher had brought a 12-year-old with him from California. So everybody was very eager to meet us in New York. London was different, and Kathleen and Richard, Chris's mother and brother, were formidable, and he wanted to be sure that Kathleen got the proper instruction of, that she had to be nice to me. And she was. I eventually went up to see them both. Actually, that first trip to London, it was Kathleen Richard who came down from Wibberley Hall, the family home, to see Chris and me together. And Kathleen was very nice to me.
To be gay in those days was criminal, or the act involved in it were criminal, they had no problem with it. They were just totally open and accepting, were they?
Well, I don't know how much Chris told them. I don't think he went into any sordid physical detail, but they both knew that I was his new boyfriend, yes, and they were prepared for that. yeah.
There are lovely descriptions. I mean, it's a refrain that runs through it of him trying to protect you from the conditions at Wibberley Hall, that it's damp and it's smelly.
When I did finally get up to Wibberley, yes, it was good that I was prepared.
I mean, it's a massive book of letters. Mm-hmm. Were you aware that you were writing something that at some point would have a public face?
Oh, not at all. Either of us would have been horrified at the thought of these letters being published one day. I kept all of mine. I really kept everything written by Chris to me, but especially those letters. And I didn't find out until after he was dead that he kept all of his too.
You're an artist, and there are some lovely, rather kitsch cat illustrations, lots and lots of illustrations, right? Cat paws, cat pictures, graffiti, well, cat faces.
He often put drawings into his letters because I asked him to. Being an artist myself, I was particularly charmed by Chris's drawings because he was one of these people who had absolutely no talent for drawing at all. His drawings were so imaginative, so unexpected, and his idea of drawing his image as a Dobbin was just wildly funny to me. So from early on, I asked him whenever he wrote, oh, please do include a drawing. And yes, he was wonderfully inventive doing his drawings of old Dobbin. Certainly within the first couple of years we were living together, we already had our animal personas. In later years, I had no idea how early that started, but eventually it took over completely whenever we were alone. But we were very private about it, and nobody else ever met the animals. And the thought of introducing anybody to them was unthinkable.
Mm-hmm. And one thing that you reveal is that it partly came out of his obsession with Beatrix Potter, which was very surprising to me.
Oh, he had an entire set, and I adored her. Things like the Roly-Poly Pudding and Mrs. Tiggy Winkle.
Catherine, I'd like to bring you in now. You've edited four volumes of Christopher's diaries, and this cache of letters, what did it mean to you to be involved in this project?
Having Don's voice join with Chris's was an astonishing, exciting thing for me. I think that the letter conversation is so much more intimate, so much more private. It's very different from the diaries. And to me, Don typed these up himself in the 90s. And when we were nearing the completion of the diary project, which took more than 15 years, he just very quietly sent me this manila envelope, just didn't say much at all, just say, have a look at this. And I read them through just with astonishment because it's a complete portrait of a long-term relationship with this incredibly intimate bond with two people who entertain one another, who are very hard on each other, who are together, who are apart. We don't have, you know, in the annals of literature, I don't think there is another collection so personal and so complete, certainly not between two men. And, you know, to understand what a relationship is that can last and what the components are and how people achieve this, revealed so candidly.
You talk about them being hard on each other. And Don, you were quite critical of some of his works, and he was quite wounded, wasn't he, or blessé by some of your comments. But then somehow you managed to get, he would accept them.
He always encouraged me to be frank about my responses. And when I became skeptical with him about his enthusiasm for my reaction, he absolutely assured me, no, there was no question. And he wasn't kidding. You see, he wasn't condescending to me. He was treating me as an equal, and it took me a long time to realize that was as important to him to regard me as an equal as it was for me to be open with him and to treat him as my equal. And that was what was so fascinating about him as a personality. He really wasn't kidding.
Catherine, are there any particular instances that you would pick up where you feel Don's feedback actually shaped what Christopher did?
Oh yeah, there are a lot. And the thing is, until now, what we've had from the diaries is things like Chris saying, well, we're down on the beach and I was talking to Don about my novel, A Single Man, and suddenly it seemed clear that it should be not about a woman, as he was originally writing that novel, but about a man. Don provided him with so many of his titles as well. But what we have in these letters, Chris sent Don in London the manuscript for Down There on a Visit, which had in it an episode of drug taking. And Don writes as an accomplished critic, just to the bone, clear and absolutely with, I think, right on his side. Chris, you've got to take
the hashish scenes out.
Take out the hashish scene because it undermines, this is not the kind of vision and enlightenment that you're really trying to explain to your readers. And Chris became a Hindu in California, and took up an alternative way of life and a new way forward. And so to describe what this experience was, Don was really tough with him. And it's a kind of team spirit. Like, I'm on your team, so you want people to understand this. I can see what the critics are going to say, and here's why, and you've got to take this out. Now, this is coming from the younger member of a pair, which was sort of widely regarded as Chris and his boyfriend. And it turns out that on the inside of this relation, the dynamic was, as Don has just said, you know, two equals. And there was a lot of this going on all the time. They wrote scripts together, you know, worked in the theater, movie scripts, and it was a collaboration. And in those works, which that also comes across in the letters. I think the very first letter in 1956, Don is on his own in London. Chris is in Cheshire. Don starts to write a play. You know, the knowledge that they both had of the theater and films, it was just a constant interest, obsession, really, for both of them.
You did have lovers outside the relationship.
Oh, yes, indeed, because I said to him, after we were together a few years, he'd had so much experience before he met me. Was it fair to deny me my own little adventures? And he was reluctant because he was afraid I would find somebody that I wanted to replace him with. I insisted, and I did have affairs, but I took great trouble to reassure him always. And if I got a little more involved with a certain person, I was very careful not to give him that impression. And also, it was very difficult on the other end. The people I was getting involved with sometimes were getting involved with me, and I had to be very careful not hurting them or making them feel that I was just dabbling with him. I had to be very diplomatic at both ends.
This is an open relationship, a really, really rare example of an open relationship that really did work and was romantic right the way through to the end, isn't it, Catherine?
Yeah, and I think that one of the things about these animal identities that is important to think about is that in the world of creaturely warmth and a world where there are not moral judgments made, it is possible to explore character. Chris wanted to pursue a path that didn't exist yet, and Don as well. So they were looking for a way to live that hadn't been done so far. I mean, you'll see Chris will be reading, you know, Byron's letters and trying to figure out, so, you know, what do you do when you feel jealous? I mean, what does that amount to? How can you deal with that? And exploring every mood that goes with the idea of an open relationship. And the animal creatures play a role in removing kind of standard conventional moral judgments and say, you know, here's a bond. We're always united in this basket together at the end of days when we're at home. But who are we really in our creaturely beings? And to give someone enough space to actually explore that without it being subject to a conventional moral judgment. I think there was a really important depth to the animals that allowed the physical bond to perpetuate a feeling of unity even while they went off and did these other things.
You see, for instance, my man friends away from Chris became my mice. It was so much easier for Chris and me to deal with these figures as mice rather than real threats to our relationship.
There's a refrain that goes through the sort of middle part of the letters about actually you not having very much money, the two of you. And he's always saying, could you not get Tony Richardson to give him a job? Could you not? Can you get them to pay for my plane fare to come over?
Well, you see, we were both artists. Chris took movie jobs to support us, and he did that for years before he and I got together. And he didn't get very much income from his novel writing. And here was I in a very chancy profession doing portraits of people. There's no assurance that I'm going to help out. And I remember one of my first real successes as a portrait artist, I got a check, my first check for $1,000. Without any instruction from Chris, I asked Chris, shouldn't this go into our account rather than opening a bank account for my own? And I realized later that was a kind of test that I'd passed from his point of view, my first real money coming in. So, yes, we were partners.
You worked together also, as well as being partners. Frankenstein, tell us about that. How was that?
In the first months we were together, he was just finishing a novel called The World in the Evening. He was doing a final draft, and I happened to have taken a typing class in junior high school. I was a very good typist, and he would dictate to me, and I was good enough. I could keep up with him typing along. So we were collaborating in the very first months we knew each other. So by the time we were actually writing a film script together, it was second nature to us. I'm not a professional writer, so we would discuss everything, decide on the plot line, get all the characters lined up, and then when the real work of writing began, I could just sit there and take dictation as I had in those first months. Of course, Chris insisted on acknowledging our collaboration, but all kinds of friends of mine said, well, of course, it's really Chris doing all the writing, isn't it? You don't really participate. You're just a standby. I knew they thought that, and I didn't sweat about it. And we actually wrote a play together. We adapted one of his novels, A Meeting by the River. Kate here is responsible for the first time that people are taking me seriously as a writer because of this book. And it's real proof, you see, that I could write, even years and years ago. But it was The Animal Secret.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.